Yeah, hi guys. I'm Aaron. It's a small crew, so we can keep it super informal. I'm very happy to be interrupted at any time. Also, I'm used to speaking to astronomers and astrophysicists, not necessarily particle physicists, although I consider myself a particle astrophysicist. So if something doesn't make sense, because I'm using words that astronomers make up, let me know and we'll make it make sense. Okay, good. So this is what I'm going to talk to you today. I'm going to talk to you today about a dream that I have of seeing directly into the merger and the collision of two neutron stars, and why we want to do that, what's so compelling about it, why it's hard, and then some things that myself and my collaborators have been doing to try to do that. And so let's get started. So hopefully that you guys know that via the, I guess, vagaries of stellar evolution, the universe is kind enough to give us binaries of compact objects, right? These can be black holes, they can be neutron stars, they can be a combination of the two. And it's very kind of the universe that eventually these compact objects via mass transfer or whatever process get close enough that via the emission of gravitational radiation, they can merge within a Hubble time. Okay, that's the entirety. I'll talk about stars. Stars give that to us. Good. What's very compelling, however, about these mergers is that depending on their mass, the mass ratio, the spins, what it's made of, whether it's degenerate matter or space-time, the outcome of this merger is very different. And it traces the end states of stellar evolution, and in particular, it gives you a glimpse directly into the birth of a black hole, in the case of a neutron star merger, that is not hidden inside the stellar envelope, right? For a core collapse supernova, you have a black hole that forms, but it's deep inside the star, and it's very difficult to understand what's going on in there. For a neutron star merger, this is happening in a pretty naked environment, and in principle, gives us access to very compelling physics. But more than this, since we're in a particle physics seminar, I guess, I want to think about these things as the universe's colliders, right? What are these things, right? These are solar masses of material accelerated and slammed together at substantial fractions 0.3, 0.4c when they come together, right? That's what's going on, right? These are the biggest and most powerful colliders in the universe. And just like any particle physicist should do, whether they're an astroparticle physicist or whatever, we want to study the physics that comes out of these mergers. So what's the physics? What's so compelling? There's a few things. One, right? One, there's the black hole formation that I talked about. There's also, in the case of the neutron stars, this supernuclear matter and its equation of state and how it performs, whether it's liquid in the interior, whether they're quark stars, all of this stuff that when you crack these two big eggs together, you should be able to access. If you're interested in chemistry, if you're interested in the origin of the elements or nucleosynthesis, there's also a rich and compelling, like in this very special environment where you spill all these free neutron guts out, you can do this rapid R process capture where you have heavy nuclei that grab neutrons from the environment and via these unique nucleosynthetic reaction networks can quickly build very heavy elements in ways that you can't elsewhere in the universe. So this is very compelling if you care about where those come from. Of course, also, during these mergers, you accelerate matter. In some cases, to several nines the speed of light, gamma factors of 100 or above. So we're talking about ultra-relativistic jets. If you're interested in jet physics, amplification of magnetic fields, et cetera, these are very powerful laboratories. And then also, because they are so bright in both many wavelengths and many messengers, they can probe the universe and be used for cosmography to measure the Hubble constant, but in principle, not only the Hubble constant, but also H of Z, omega dm of Z, omega lambda of Z as we go out into the distant universe. So these are very, very rich laboratories. And like our particle colliders on the ground, we want to build very rich, very complicated instruments to reap all of the rich physics that comes out, right? On the ground, we build our atlases and our CMS experiments around the biggest collider on the ground, and we want to do that here. The fundamental problem, which I'll hopefully try to explain why it's a problem, is that unlike, the LHC or our laboratories in the building, which generally don't move around or vanish, I guess subject to administrative whim when they shut us down, we don't actually know where these colliders are, right? So if we want to take our versions of our ATLAS and our CMS experiments, which is our Hubble and our James Webb and our Chandra and our VLA, to point directly in the merger at the very early times and reap the sort of very compelling physics, we have to know where these are. So I'm going to talk to you about a little bit about that today. And in order to understand why this is a problem, it's useful to understand what's going on. So on the left, we have this nice cartoon by Rodrigo Fernandez and Brian Metzger, of the sort of a cartoon of the physics that's going on as a function of the coalescence time around the merger, and on the top, the sort of radiative phenomenology associated with that physics, right? So we have these two in-spiraling neutron stars. They produce gravitational waves. In principle, right before the merger, they could produce electromagnetic phenomena, whether it's via magnetospheric interaction or tidal strain cracking the crust. There are many mechanisms that has not been seen. Then there's the merger. Very quickly, depending on the masses of those component objects, you either promptly form a black hole or you have a hypermassive neutron star that's supported against collapse by differential rotation. You have an accretion disk of material that's sort of split, that's sort of thrown out during this collision. You can launch an ultra-relativistic jet, which shows up as a gamma ray burst on the sky within a couple seconds. Over longer time scales of tens to hundreds of seconds, if you have a hypermassive neutron star, you get extreme magnetic field amplification in this merger. This is going to be a magnetar. This can inject more energy into the post-merger environment. On longer timescales yet, you have even slower moving ejecta that we call dynamical ejecta. It's only moving at 0.1 or 0.2 C instead of 99.999 C. This stuff is where the so-called kilonova happens. This is where that those free neutrons get captured onto the heavy ions. You make these R-process elements, but they're unstable. Their radioactive decay heats this ejecta, and you get a thermal transient that evolves over hours to days timescale that we call a kilonova. And then even over longer timescales, that ejecta interacts with the circumstellar material around the merger environment, driving synchrotron radiation. And so there's electromagnetic emission on all timescales, on many length scales from the ISCO to, you know, solar system size scales as these things get out there, and in all across the multi-wavelength and multi-messenger spectrum. It's important to understand for this purpose what the relative, to really grasp what the relative time scales and luminosities of these things are, because if we want to capture these things at the very earliest times, we have to know where to look and where to train our telescopes. Right, I'm an experimental astrophysicist. I want to build instruments that can access this physics. Right, so at the very earliest times, we have that ultra-relativistic jet. It comes out within a second or so. It can reach 10 to the 52 ergs if you're looking right ergs per second of luminosity. If you're looking straight down the barrel of the jet. If you're looking at the jet at a wider angle, it could be 10,000 times less luminous, maybe 10 to the 46 ergs per second. It lasts just a couple seconds, if that. Over, if you're looking down the barrel of the jet, as that ultra-relativistic jet interacts with the circumstellar material, it drives the synchrotron afterglow, which you'll see as monotonically decaying over time, starting out very bright and going fainter. If you're not looking down the axis of the jet, the first semi-isotropic signal comes out on thousands of seconds to days timescale in that thermally driven transient that everyone talks about called the kilonova. And that's fainter still, peaks at 10 to the 42 ergs per second. For context, that's about 1,000 times dimmer than a supernova. Right, so these are bright, but they're not supernova bright, the thermal transient. And then on longer timescales yet, you have this off-axis afterglow. It's important to keep all these things in mind. Okay, so there has been one of these things so far, right? We have one neutron star merger that's detected in both gravitational waves and the electromagnetic spectrum. It's called gravitational wave 170817. It was detected in LIGO-Hanford interferometer, LIGO-Livingston interferometer. These are the basically spectrograms. So this is the power in the gravitational wave interferometer in frequency time pixels, and you see this nice track towards merger. We were extremely lucky here, and I want to stress how lucky we were. This was a neutron star merger at 40 megaparsecs, right? This, depending on what you do, this is either very close or very far. But if you, given our best understanding today, if you calculate the rates of something like this, this is a 1 in 20 year event. So if we ran our gravitational wave interferometers for 20 years continuously, which we don't, they're not continuous, the duty cycle is not even close to perfect, something this close and this easy to access the physics of will not happen again for a very long time, okay? And that folds into other things about how we find it that hopefully will become clear. Yeah.
What's the average understanding, like 20 years plus minus one?
Yeah, yeah, plus or minus. So it's asymmetric error bars, okay? It could be, right now, the uncertainty on the volumetric rate of BNS mergers is dependent on your mass function, but if you assume a flat mass function, it's anywhere from 20 per cubic gigaparsec per year to 800, okay? So it's like 1.5 orders of magnitude, at least, okay? Big error bars. as we run our detectors for longer and longer, we'll know this. And those rates then propagate into many other things, like can you enrich the whole universe chemically with that number of neutron star mergers, et cetera. But yeah, big uncertainties, but it's definitely not more than a 1 in 10 year event. Okay, very lucky. But even though, so we were so lucky, and there was a lot of rich physics that came out. But what you're looking at here is a map, is a sort of diagram of all of the observations in gravitational waves and across the electromagnetic spectrum that were performed for this event. And what you see over a function of time, and what you see is that there's this huge gap right here that's missing. Early time focused observations. Our first observation of the kilonova with our focused telescopes was 12 hours after the merger. Right? These are relativistic objects that are slamming together. There's many dynamical timescales between merger and 12 hours where all of your most interesting and rich physics is actually living. And Hubble didn't get on target for 2 days. Okay. Just to sort of slam home, people have been talking about this kilonova now for 6.5 years.
Swift's still going?
I'll get there. I'll get there. People have been talking about this kilonova for 6.5 years. You've probably heard infinite things about it. Maybe not. I don't know if you talk about it in particle physics, but in astrophysics, everyone talks about it. What you're looking at here, however, is an attempt to actually understand the physics. Not just look at it, but to understand the physics. So what in the solid and dashed lines on both panels, what you're looking at is four different models that attempt to explain what's going on via either a single component radioactive decay model, a model that includes that with shock cooling, internal to the photosphere, a different reactive decay model that has different chemical abundances and line opacities of the heavy elements, and a shock cooling only model. And I could have put 50 models up here. What you're looking at in the dots are the photometric observations from the IR to the UV matched to these models. And what you see is that they are all degenerate. We actually have no idea what we were looking at. Okay, we have no idea what the abundances of the heavy elements were in here, what the lanthanide abundances were, what the fraction, what the geometry of the ejecta was, what the velocity was, basically unconstrained by models. However, what you see is that if you push to earlier times, and particularly in this case for the kilonova to the blue, then you can break these degeneracies. So this is just one example of why early time observations are important, but there are many, many others. If you're interested in what is the remnant? Right? What is the maximum mass of a neutron star? Is it set by the TOV mass or not? Right? What is, you know, how does a black hole form? How does the outcome of the nucleosynthesis depend on the remnant if there's extra energy injection in the merger? How do you launch ultra-relativistic jets, right? What determines its opening angle, its structure function? And name your favorite question about accretion, about black hole formation, about compact objects, about supernuclear matter, about ultra-relativistic flows. All of these robustly require access to these environments of these collisions from the very earliest times. And it's something that even in this case where we were so lucky for this close-by thing, we didn't get to. So why is this hard, right? Hopefully I've convinced you that, you know, the physics is very compelling. There have been thousands of papers written on the physics you could do with these neutron star mergers. That we did amazing amounts of physics, even only accessing the late time. And if we can access the early time, it'll be amazing. So why is it so hard to access the early time, right? And the fundamental reason is that the gravitational wave localizations are poor. What's amazing about gravitational waves is that they tell us what and when very well, right? So gravitational waves directly track the acceleration of the matter in the system or of the mass energy in the system. And they tell us very, very precisely that that thing is going to merge and when it's going to merge. But right now, they are very poor at telling us where it's going to merge. So it's very difficult to build our most sensitive instruments around those sites if we don't know where they're going to be. What you're looking at here are examples of gravitational wave localization sky maps on the sky. Here is the second neutron star merger, and so far we've only detected two. This did not have an electromagnetic counterpart we detected. Why is that? Well, they localized it to 1/4 of the sky. 10,000 square degrees is 1/4 of the sky, okay? They said, okay, it's somewhere in that quarter. That's really hard, right? These things, you know, they're bright, but they're not tremendously bright. Searching 1/4 of the sky with sensitive instruments is a very hard thing to do. Please interrupt if you're confused or you need to ask a question.
So this previous one, like this 1708,
yes,
you know, that was seen. That was also seen again on gamma rays, right?
Yes. Okay, I'll get there. I promise. And people, and so, you know, one thing that you can do to improve these gravitational wave localization regions and make them smaller so that you have less sky to search to find these things at all or even quicker is to build more gravitational wave detectors, right? The gravitational wave localization is essentially a timing measurement, right? The distance between Hanford and Livingston, the two LIGO detectors, is 10 milliseconds at the speed of gravity, right? Virgo is another 25 milliseconds. Okay? If you build more baselines, you can start to constrain the size of these localization regions on the sky. You're set by the size of the Earth, so they can't become infinitely good, right? You're not going to get arc-second scale localization, but you can do that. But the problem remains that that will only, for a neutron star merger at a fixed distance, like 50 megaparsecs or 100 megaparsecs, the localization size will improve with more detectors and more sensitive detectors. But we have this volume-limited survey of neutron star mergers. The majority of the, and these are rare things, the majority of the population will always live out near the horizon of the detector in the low SNR regime. And robustly, even as we make our detectors better and we build more of them, for the median event, which is near the threshold, you get a localization of 1,000 square degrees, which is still tremendously large on the sky. So this cannot be solved only by building better gravitational wave detectors or more of them, even if we had billions of dollars to throw at it. Okay. Okay, great. So as an example of how hard this problem is, I said the median localization region is 1,000 square degrees. Let's look at an example of an extremely high SNR event that has a much better localization to see how difficult this problem really is. So what you're looking at here is a screenshot from an application that I built that's meant to coordinate all of the telescopes in the world to search these large localization regions. And this red contour that you're looking at here and buried under some of those polygons there is localization region for a gravitational wave event called 190814. This was not a neutron star merger. It was a very strange 10-to-1 high mass ratio compact object event. Very unexpected. What's interesting about it is that's the most well-localized gravitational wave source on the sky today, 18 square degrees, right? So this is 50 times better than the median event. And what you're looking at on this page is the polygons representing the footprints of telescopes that tried to image this localization region to search for the electromagnetic counterpart as quickly as possible. And from the fact that it's just covered, it looks like they did a really, really good job, right? And we're talking about, you know, many thousands of exposures, many dozens of the best instruments of the world searching this 20 square degrees. But if you time resolve this coverage, it starts to look substantially worse. On the vertical axis, this is recording the fraction of the, yes?
The little box like in the previous slide is like the field of view of this?
Yes, sorry, I apologize. Each polygon represents the instantaneous footprint of the image taken by a telescope. Right, so that's the field of view. So you see some telescopes have very big fields of view, some telescopes have very small fields of view. Normally, this is inversely related to the collecting area of the telescope, so inversely related to the depth it achieves. Sorry about that. Okay, so what you're looking at now, instead of just the blanket coverage, is the fraction of the gravitational wave localization region that was searched as a function of time. And even for this thing that was 50 times smaller than the median gravitational wave event, it still took about 10 hours to search the majority of that localization region. This is how difficult this problem is. If you're interested in the early time physics, this is not the way to do it. But this is what everybody is doing. Everyone's building is trying to leverage these large optical time domain surveys that are built on the ground to search for gravitational wave counterparts. It's a good idea. It's never going to get you the early time physics. If you look in the UV, where I told you early time is even more important, it's even slower because we don't have good UV telescopes to search with. And the searching is only the first step. Another problem with the kilonova, using kilonova, this optical UVOIR thermally powered transient to search, is that the UVOIR sky is very busy. Okay, there's supernova going off, there's AGN burbling, there's stars flaring. And so when you do these wide field searches across a lot of the sky, you find tons of things changing. And if what your goal is to put James Webb on target or Hubble or Chandra or VLA, you have to know which one it is, right? And that candidate characterization step and vetting also robustly takes a few days. So the search phase takes a few days if you're searching the sky in the optical. And then you have to use the biggest telescopes in the world, Keck and Gemini 10-meter glass, to get spectra of these things to characterize it before you have a counterpart that you can actually slew Hubble or James Webb or VLA onto. And this is, the same thing, best localized source to date, hundreds of candidates that had to be vetted. It took a week. Okay. So those are two problems. The wide field search is slow. Then you have to characterize it. All those things you find in that wide field search, that's also slow. Also, another thing is, right, as I showed you, the kilonova is thermally powered. It doesn't even begin to rise until a few hours after the merger. So if you're interested in the early times, using the kilonova or the thermal transient to discover, to know where to point, is always going to be the wrong thing to do because it's not produced radiatively soon enough. Another problem, as we build better gravitational wave detectors, and if you're interested in using neutron star mergers or gravitational wave sources for standard sirens or cosmography, is that the kilonova, again, peaks at 10 to the 42 ergs per second. Okay? This is not very bright. The next generation of gravitational wave detectors will be measuring neutron star mergers out to Z of 2.5. This is an amazing opportunity to do standard sirens to trace like the equation of state of dark energy, right? Or our cosmological parameters as a function of Z. What you're looking at here is the horizon, the median distance at which neutron star mergers will be detected by this 40-kilometer interferometer that's being proposed, Cosmic Explorer. It's basically LIGO times 10. And then if you took the Vera Rubin Observatory, which is the sort of billion-dollar class survey telescope that's probably the best thing that you could do, and you tried to search for these things, the maximum distance, if you gave all of LSST time just to hunting for kilonova from gravitational waves, at which you could recover it. And so there's a bunch of problems. The kilonova is too faint in the cosmological universe, and even in the local universe, searching for it is too slow, and anyway, it rises too late. Okay, so hopefully I've beaten that point to death, right? Searching, if you want to access the early time physics, this is not the right thing to do. If you want to do this at cosmological distances, this is not the right thing to do. What is the right thing to do? One approach is to use the gamma ray burst. I moved over it quickly before, but why is it compelling, right? It's brighter. Right? Even if you're, off axis, it peaks at 10 to the 46 ergs per second. If you're on axis, we've already seen these things out to Z of 3 and in some cases Z of 9, right? These are the brightest explosions in the universe. Okay, it's brighter. Also, our gamma ray instruments are capable of instantaneously surveying, detecting gamma rays coming from almost the entire sky or large fractions of the sky, which means you bypass this wide field search phase. You don't have to spend days scanning the sky searching for it. Okay, that's two. Three, the gamma ray sky is really dark. Unlike the optical, which is all these things burbling, there's one gamma ray burst on the whole sky per day, period. Okay, which means that if you detect a gamma ray burst within a couple seconds of your gravitational waves, you can know to 7 sigma that it is the counterpart immediately, and there's no characterization problem. Okay, so bright, instantaneous survey of wide field of sky, and we bypass the characterization problem. So in principle, this can give us access to the very early time physics. And indeed, for 1708-17, there was a neutron star merger detected, and 1.6 seconds later, a gamma ray burst. And if this is just a time series of gamma ray counts as a function of time. Okay, so why didn't we access the early time physics if we detected it? And the reason is, most gamma ray burst detectors are even worse than LIGO at telling you where in the sky they came from, right? Gamma rays are very hard to localize. They will go right through your focusing optics. You're not focusing gamma rays. What you're looking at here, this is the in green, the localization region from gravitational wave data. In red, the localization region from gamma ray data from a single satellite. And in gray, the timing annulus produced by the gamma rays being detected at the Fermi spacecraft and at the Integral spacecraft and their delay. And you see that these localizations are even worse. As you might say, Aaron, okay, what's the point, right? Okay, yeah, the gamma ray comes quickly. Yeah, you don't have to search for it, but you don't know where to point your telescope. Okay, but there is a way. There is a way to do this, and it's to do the dark arts and to do a technique called coded aperture imaging. So it's true that you can't focus your gamma rays, but if you make a large focal plane of gamma ray sensitive detectors, and then you put an occulting object above it, and you shine a gamma ray flashlight onto that object, the position of the shadow that's cast by that object, let's say it's opaque to gamma rays like lead, encodes information about the incident angle of gamma rays on the sky. And if you're smart about it, you can build a pattern of occulting objects that breaks all of the shadow degeneracies and encodes a unique shadow pattern onto the detector plane for every possible sky distribution of sources. And this technique is called coded aperture imaging. The biggest and most sensitive such instrument ever launched is the Burst Alert Telescope on SWIFT, called the BAT. What it's made of is 32,000 individual cadmium zinc telluride hard X-ray and gamma ray detectors covering half a square meter on the focal plane. 1 meter above that is a mask made of 55,000 lead elements, each 5 millimeters square, in a random pattern on the mask substrate, which is 2.5 square meters in area. The distance, 1 meter, the size, 2.5 square meters, and the pixel pitch of the mask, 5 millimeters, sets your field of view in the sky. It's about 2.5 steradians, you know, 1/5 of the sky. Your angular resolution, and that's what you can do. And in principle, it's very easy to actually find these positions, right? What you do is you take your shadow, your data, which looks like this. It's not very pretty, but I promise you there's thousands of overlapping shadows in here. You do a cross-correlation with your known mask pattern. We know it because we built it, right? And then, if this is just a complex multiplication in Fourier space, and what you reconstruct computationally is your sky image. And this has actually been done. This instrument was built 20 years ago. It's in space right now. It can localize gamma ray bursts to arc minute precision. Why is arc minute important? The James Webb field of view is 2 arc minutes across. The VLA field of view is 5 to 10 arc minutes across. Chandra is comparable. The best telescopes in the world have fields of view of about a few arc minutes across. If you want to bypass the wide field search phase and get your instruments on target immediately, that's the scale of the localization that we need. Gravitational waves are tens of degrees. Other gamma ray burst instruments are tens of degrees. Okay, great.
How long does it really get for Chandra or VLD to focus on that argument? That's probably not right.
Yes, that's right now we're dominated by the wide field search phase. If we could give them a position immediately, then we'd be dominated by their operational latency, which is order a day. I'll talk later about some things that we're doing to improve this. Okay. So intrinsically, this detector is not only capable of arc minute scale localization, it's also the most sensitive gamma ray burst detector ever launched, right? It's like half a square meter of effective area of cadmium zinc telluride detectors. This is a lot. It records each gamma ray count that hits the detectors to 100 microsecond relative timing. Its energy of each gamma ray photon in one of 4,000 energy channels from 15 to 500 kiloelectron volts, and which of the 32,768 detectors it hit. Okay? And with this information, you can detect even the most underluminous gamma ray bursts at wide off-axis angles from the jet out to substantial distances, and much farther than any other gamma ray instrument like Fermi or Integral. Okay, and this is important because although the majority of the cosmological population of GRBs are very bright, the brightest objects in the universe, this one, 170817, was 10,000 times underluminous because we were looking at it from this, the jet from this side. Okay. So this is what you could do if you had that data, and that data that I described is the so-called event data. Each and every gamma ray count with its time, its energy, and its position. The problem was, right, I'm an experimental astrophysicist, so now I'm going to talk about experimental stuff. So, I mean, I don't know if you care, but that's what I'm going to talk about. The problem was that Swift was not actually designed to do that. Swift was designed to do this on board. This cross-correlation is very easy, right? It runs even in a couple seconds, even on a Pentium processor from the 90s, which is on board the spacecraft. And Swift was designed to promptly localize to arc minutes gamma ray burst so you could slew detectors on target. And if you didn't promptly localize it, it didn't care, which meant that you're limited by the capability of the onboard computer to find these things. It also meant that it didn't care about bringing down all the raw data to the ground, which is a problem. The reason why I say it didn't care is basically the effective area, I told you, is a very sensitive instrument. It's very large. So the data rate is very large for a gamma ray instrument. The recorders onboard the spacecraft are incapable of storing all of it. And the antenna onboard the spacecraft is too low bandwidth to bring it down even if it could store all of it. So basically, for the first 15, 16 years of this mission, which has now been up for 19 years, we relied on these data analysis scripts that were written in 2000 that are running on processors from the 1990s that are finding gamma ray bursts very well, but not this very faint population that we could find if we could bring all the data to the ground and run our most sensitive and advanced analytic techniques. But there's a saving grace, which is that, like many radio telescopes you might be familiar with, the instrument has a buffer, a ring buffer, where it saves the data, which is like a baseband buffer on a radio telescope. It saves 27 million gamma ray counts into this ring buffer before overwriting. Given the average background rates, this corresponds to a ring buffer duration of 20 minutes. If you could get a command up to the spacecraft, like let's say LIGO detects a neutron star merger, you send a command to the spacecraft, you say, save this data out of the ring buffer, bring it to the ground as fast as you can, then you could save this data and do these very sensitive analyses. The problem was, as I just told Daniel, the command latency for spacecraft is normally order days, and for Swift, even being as swift as it is, was hours as of a couple years ago, which is much too long to get this data to ring it down. So I invested a lot of time in solving this, and we did. It's called Guano, the Gamma Ray Urgent Archive for Phenomenal Opportunities, because we dump the bat, right? We're dumping the bat ring buffer. What is it? This is not science. This is radio frequency engineering, right? This is a new command and control scheme for spacecraft that allows us to command them very quickly to dump the ring buffer, mark the data for high priority downlink, and bring it down to the ground really quickly. It was the first ever autonomous and on-demand commanding of a space telescope. Now it's enabling all sorts of very cool FRB physics. It's actually used by this, by not just for this science now, but for Swift, for all of its operations. And it allows us, with 95% success rate, to get this photon level event data to the ground for analysis. And so now we have the data on the ground, we can start doing this imaging. I told you before, you take the shadow pattern that's cast on the detector, and you cross-correlate it with the known mask pattern to reconstruct the sky position, the sky image. There's a few problems here. If you look at the population of sources that you find in the sky image, you see something curious, which is that what you're looking at here is the reverse cumulative distribution function as a function of SNR for sources that you find in these reconstructed sky images. And you see that at about SNR 6.5, you go from signal dominated, all of these are real gamma ray bursts, to noise dominated. All of that is fake. And there is, of course, a real population of sources that lives in there, but you don't know which ones they are. And so you're basically fundamentally limited by this noise population. I can explain where it comes from later if people are interested. In addition, if you're correlating the mask pattern with the detector, it means that you're necessarily throwing out any counts that get to the detector via paths that don't pass through the mask holes. And that might sound good, right? That's where the localizing information is. But it's actually not good because a few things. One, there's localizing information from in principle from every photon that you get, even if it reaches the detector coming through the bottom, right? We can utilize this, and it contributes counts and signal. This is signal. We don't want to throw it out. You don't want to throw out any information, and this cross-correlation technique does that. In addition, it throws out other information, right? This is cross-correlating the spatial correlations between the detector and the mask. But as I said, we are also measuring the relative time of photons to 100 microsecond accuracy and the energy in each of 4,000 channels. And this analysis does not include this energy information, which also contains information that we can use to localize. In addition, it pays this mask weighting efficiency factor. I can describe this later. You're throwing out even more information because of the fact that the detector does not have perfect spatial resolution and imperfectly resolves the shape of the shadow. So you cannot ever achieve your maximum possible SNR. All of these put together mean that while in principle the effective area, so the sensitivity of the instrument as a function of photon energy, is this blue curve, which peaks at over 2,500 square centimeters of effective area at 100 kiloelectron volts. For the first 15 years of the mission, people were using an analysis technique that had an effective area that looked like this orange curve because their analysis technique was throwing out all this information. And kind of no one realized, which is kind of sad. So the question is there a way to exploit the full sensitivity of the instrument while still achieving the arc minute scale localizations that cross-correlation gives you? And the answer is yes. So what we do is instead of starting with the data and cross-correlating it with the mass pattern to reconstruct the sky image, we start with the sky image. And we forward model the whole sky through the complicated instrument response onto the detector, simulate data on the detector plane, compare the simulated data to the observed data with a likelihood test. This is not real data. This is simulated data. What you're looking at here is a gamma ray burst coming, like this is the detector, the 32,000 detectors, a meter away is the shadow mask. What you're looking at is a gamma ray burst with this fluence, 5 × 10⁻⁶ ergs per centimeter squared, coming at an angle of 35 degrees off the Bohr site. So let me think. Right, I am the gamma ray burst, you are the gamma ray burst, and you're looking at the instrument. This is what the instrument sees, right? The shadow pattern of the mask is cast onto the detector here, and this rapidly changing response, right, this is the expected number of counts per pixel, is what's encoding the arcminute scale position. But because our spacecraft isn't made of lead, there are counts that reach the detector, even though they don't pass through the holes in the mask. And what you're seeing here is the spacecraft structure around the instrument, and this has spatial information hidden inside of it that you can use. Even if you don't go through the mask at all, even if you send a gamma ray burst up through the bottom of the spacecraft, and the gamma rays do go through the bottom of the spacecraft and hit the detector from the bottom, you make this beautiful Rothko painting, there's spatial and structural information to exploit here. And so that's what we do. Depending on the spectrum of the source and the position on the sky, using a technique like this is anywhere from 3 to infinitely times more sensitive than cross-correlation. Why infinite? Well, for cross-correlation imaging, you turn off at 200 kV because this is where your mask tiles become more or less transparent to gamma rays. But the detector, this cadmium zinc telluride effective area, continues out to 500 kilo-electron volts. So for a hard spectrum source, you can detect these, you know, infinitely times better than with a cross-correlation approach.
Then you cannot localize anymore.
This is right. There's a trade.
Right.
And there's a spectrum inside of this. However, I hope you'll believe me that if you're only using this information to derive a localization instead of this information plus the structure here, and this is only at one energy, right? This structure changes as a function of energy because the transmissive properties of the spacecraft and some other things I'll get into in a second change as a function of energy. And so you can use all of this information to localize. But yes, it's true. If it's a monochromatic source at 500 kiloelectron volts, you're not localizing it. But luckily, there are no gamma ray lasers.
I'm confused about what your axes here?
Oh, these axes are detector coordinates. Each of these boxes is a pixel. This is the focal plane of the instrument. So each of these boxes is, and this is actually almost, in given this projector, almost the real size of the instrument. Each of this is a 4 mm² cadmium zinc telluride detector, and it's color. Each one of them is color coded by the expected number of gamma ray counts it will measure in whichever energy bin I chose for this plot. I don't remember. For a gamma ray burst at this fluence hitting the instrument from this angle, which is about from here. Okay. What am I doing on time? Okay, great. So this search technique is actually very complicated because I said we make these simulations, right? But of course, I don't know what the right position on the sky is. So I have to simulate every possible distribution of sources on the sky, forward model them through the instrument response, compare the observed data to the simulated data with a likelihood test, and then multiplex this over not only every position on the sky, but at each position, a grid of spectral parameters, right? Because the data will depend on what the gamma ray burst intrinsically looks like, which I don't know. But luckily, each of these forward models and the likelihood evaluation is independent. So if you give me a huge supercomputer, we can do this really quickly. These are some details about how we construct our likelihood tests. We treat the noise and the data correctly in the fully Poissonian regime for all of the information, both temporal and spectral and spatial. It's very computationally expensive. We have to model things. There's many things to model that are not just the gamma ray burst, right? There's the cosmic X-ray background, which is a diffuse source on the sky. There's the background induced by cosmic rays interacting with your spacecraft and causing downscatters of gamma ray particles. We have to model that. We have a model for that. There are galactic X-ray binaries and other X-ray sources, black holes in our galaxy that also make X-rays, and we have to model those on the detector. So we really because gamma ray telescopes don't have baffles and aren't perfectly collimating sources where you can block all the light, you really have to model the whole sky. And like the Earth shines, has an albedo in gamma rays, and the moon has an albedo in gamma rays, and the sun, and it's a very complicated thing to do. But you can make a compound model of all of these things. Once you have a compound model of all of these things on the sky, you have to turn that into what the detector sees. And the problem with that is that the detector is a very complicated thing. This is a sort of a CAD model of what it is, right? So these are the 32,000 pixels on the detector plane. The mask sits here, but I've removed it so you can see into it. There's a spacecraft body. There's two narrow field telescopes over there. This is covered in many different elements, multi-layer insulation, steel, aluminum, all sorts of stuff. If you ask, what does the detector see? Imagine I did have a gamma ray laser. NET gamma ray laser puts out a monochromatic beam of gamma rays with 171 keV photons. This is what the detector sees. It sees a peak at 171 keV, but it also sees many escape lines, phosphorescence and fluorescence lines, downscatters and interactions, both Compton and otherwise in the detector. This is for one line of sight on the sky. What I need this is for that line of sight, every possible gamma ray energy, and for every possible line of sight on the sky. And because the detector geometry is so complicated, these are unique. And so this is a very complicated particle physics experiment that unfortunately is in space, so we can't calibrate perfectly. This is a very hard thing to do. So we need something like this for every energy, for every line of sight on the sky. Sorry, Jeff, you had a question.
Well, just how many parameters
are in this your scan? 100. Okay, but then I have to do that for then. So that's the fixed model. And then what's not fixed is I move the gamma ray burst to every position on the sky. And then you should ask, how many spatial positions on the sky can the instrument resolve? Like, what's the fundamental resolution of the instrument such that the response will be different? And the answer for that is 1,000,000. Okay, yes.
Similar simulations for dark matter detectors. And usually the problem that we run into is that we usually don't know our detector materials well enough.
Yes.
We don't know the geometry well enough.
This is a problem.
So, we cannot quantify the uncertainties then of our simulations. So then, how do you quantify the uncertainties of your model?
Yeah, great question. I'm glad I'm on this slide, right? So this is an example of how we construct these response models. So this is what the detector sees. If you're a gamma ray burst looking at an instrument like this, the detector was last on the ground in the lab 20 years ago. Even 20 years ago, we didn't calibrate it perfectly for a few reasons. You can never calibrate something perfectly, but this technique that I'm talking about was not even conceived of 20 years ago. All they cared about was the planar approximation to the response function. They didn't care about the off-axis gamma rays. So all we have is a GEONT-4 model of the spacecraft, okay, with imperfect precision and knowledge. And of course, also, it's been in space for 20 years. The material has been activated as it passes through radiation belts. It's decayed. So even if we did know it perfectly, it's changed. So what we do is we have this GEONT model, we make a trezillion simulations of the response function, and then we use the past 20 years of data to do a data-driven calibration to try to match the simulated model. But yes, our sensitivity is systematically limited by systematic uncertainties in what the spacecraft looks like. Correct. And we can talk more. We spent years trying to do this. We'll talk more about it. This is what, you know, just some examples of what you see if the gamma ray burst is from that position. Okay. So okay, how do you turn this into a search? Well, you need to describe your models. You need to make a likelihood test statistic. What is a gamma ray burst, right? It's some temporally localized, spectrally and positionally uncertain thing on the sky. What we do is we don't know a priori when precisely the gamma ray burst is, what its duration is, what its spectral content is, or where it is. So we have to turn this into a search. So how do we do it? We run windows across the data on many timescales from 128 milliseconds to 16 seconds at time steps of a quarter of that bin width across the time series data. That's over 1,000 time bins. If you define your search window as minus 20 to plus 20 seconds around a putative neutron star coalescence, that's 1,000 time bins. I'll tell you, we can't afford to do the likelihood test for each of those 1,000 time bins. 1,000,000 spatial positions and spectral positions for each of those 1,000 time bins. So we do a seeding stage where we only keep, you know, the things in this SNR time series that pass a very low threshold of like 2.5, and we calibrated this to make sure we weren't missing anything. Okay, once we have those time seeds, then we get, for each time bin, we have to spatially grid the sky. But even for a single time bin, I can't afford to spatially and spectrally grid the sky. So first I do a coarse graining. What you're looking at here is an image of the sky in instrument coordinates. One unit is 40 degrees on the sky. What we've done here is we send a GRB simulated at each of these positions in the sky at a grid of Pryle spectral models for each position, calculate the likelihood ratio, find the best fit, zoom in, have another grid, do it again, find the best fit, zoom in even further, and eventually find the position of the gamma ray burst. But this is very complicated, even with all of these seeding stages and lots of really digging very deep into how to, like, you know, do machine arithmetic faster. It still takes 500 CPU hours per search, approximately. And we're not even searching the whole parameter space. But if you're willing, if you think it's important to find these things and to localize them quickly, you can just have a supercomputer running all the time, and that's what we do. I'm going to skip this. We've been running this now for 3 years. We haven't found a counterpart to a neutron star merger, but we found tons of other things. In fact, almost 20% of all the gamma ray bursts detected in the past 3 years have been via this system. And we've provided arc minute scale localizations and done it fast enough to give that to the community so they can repoint their telescopes and study the physics of afterglows, gamma ray bursts as a function of cosmic time, et cetera. And to give you a sense of the differences, this red region is the localization region for a gamma ray burst that was detected by Fermi. This blue dot is our position. And 5 days later, when data from the Mars orbiter came back, they were able to do an interplanetary baseline timing measurement and pinned it down to this box. So we're doing well. We know they're right because we point telescopes at it eventually and we find the afterglow, and we're doing this. And we found other cool stuff too, magnetar giant flares in other galaxies, very wide, the widest angle relativistic jets that have ever been seen have been found through this system. And we want to run this all the time. There's other data products too. We can produce the most sensitive searches even if we don't find anything, upper limits on gamma ray bursts and X-ray flares and magnetar giant flares from neutron star mergers and fast radio bursts and everything else in the sky. We now run this 10 times a day. I skip this, but we also, once you have the most sensitive gamma ray burst search in the world, in principle, multi-messenger astrophysics is about combining all of our data into a coherent picture. And that's what we're doing now. We combine the very low-level gamma ray search with the gravitational wave search for a coherent search that includes the spatial, spectral, and parametric information about each signal and computes a joint ranking statistic that includes all of this information. And you can push deeper into the noise to detect signals that are independently undetectable in any given instrument. And we've calibrated that, and now we have that running live in real time on the LIGO infrastructure as well, to push the detector horizon as well as the localization. Okay, so I've talked all about this gamma ray search, about how it can get us these arc minute scale localizations. But as you might have seen before, right, the field of view of my instrument is great, but it's not the whole sky, right? If you calculate this 2.5 square meters, a meter above half a square meter, that turns into a field of view of 2.5 steradians, which are 7,000 square degrees, which is only 1/6 of the sky. Right? So in 1/6 of the sky, I can detect these very faint gamma ray bursts and arc minute localize them, but what if it's somewhere else? And while we don't know a priori where a neutron star merger will come from on the sky, we sort of can in the asymptotic limit of many detections. Because the gravitational wave interferometers are antennae, and they do not have uniform response functions on the sky. Integrated over time as the Earth spins, the LIGO and Virgo antenna pattern smears across the sky and you have a more or less uniform sensitivity. But if you're looking for something that happens at the same time as a neutron star merger, what matters is the instantaneous antenna pattern, the quadrupolar instantaneous response to the detector. And what you can do is you can systematically bias the pointing of your spacecraft such that it's following the antenna pattern across the sky and increase your effective field of view by a factor of 2 just by knowing where to point and when as a function of time. And we're doing this too, and this increases our joint detection rate by about a factor of 2 as compared to what you would expect with a field of view that's 1/6 or 1/5 of the sky. Okay, but then what if we got even crazier? The gravitational wave detectors now, like LIGO, now have sufficient low frequency sensitivity that the neutron star merger lives in band for about 100 seconds before it merges, right? It enters the frequency band about 20 hertz, emerges at 1 kilohertz. There's about 100 seconds of evolution in this time. You can imagine running, instead of the entire template as a matched filter on the gravitational wave data, which is historically done, you can imagine running truncated templates, if you can stream them in real time on the data, and claim a detection of a neutron star merger before the merger. And working with Ryan McGee at Penn State and Serbi Sachdev and others, we've built this. And this is now running in real time. And so then the question becomes, if someone told me, in 30 seconds, there'll be a neutron star merger over there. What can I do with it? As an example, in the last gravitational wave observing run, this happened. What's this? This is a sky map. This is the part of the sky that's blocked by the Earth from the perspective of the spacecraft at the gravitational wave merger time. This is the gravitational wave localization region. This is the field of view of my telescope. If I have 30 seconds, can I torque my space telescope across the sky to have this cover this, and then run this, everything I was just talking to you about, the search, dump the data, you know, send a command up to the spacecraft really quickly, bring down the data, send it to a supercomputer, burst compute it, get an arc minute scale localization, send it to Hubble, turn it around. And yeah, the answer is maybe. And so it's true that, right, if you do a truncated template, you have less signal, which means your localizations are even more poor than they would be for a full merger. But again, the field of view of my telescope is 7,000 square degrees. I don't really care. All I need to know is the vector. Which way do I slew? And I'll do a raster scan as quickly as possible across the gravity. This is what the evolution. So what we did is we injected gravitational wave signals into the detector, into the detector noise, ran these truncated template searches across the detector data, got pings at pre-merger times, extracted that data, ran parameter estimation on it to estimate the localization. And what you're looking at is the estimated localization of the gravitational wave as a function of pre-merger time. So as a function of how much of the signal you actually use to estimate the localization. And you see that it can evolve very strangely across the sky, but we understand the systematics of how this happens to know how to steer the telescope. And this is taking place over minus 50 seconds to 0 seconds around the merger time for the truncated templates. So what can we do with 50 seconds? We can do a lot. What you're looking at here is a map of the sky. Every sky pixel is color-coded by the amount of time in seconds it takes to get that sky pixel into the field of view of my coded aperture telescope using a full and complete model of the attitude control system of the spacecraft. And this is what it looks like as a function. So this is one instantaneous thing. The spacecraft starts pointing there. The Earth is there. We ran this over a wide range of possible gravitational wave localization regions across seasons to sample over all the different ephemerides and things that can affect the attitude control system. This is what it robustly looks like. The fraction of the sky you can get inside the field of view as a function of the amount of time you have to do it. With 150 seconds, we can get any position on the sky that's not behind the Earth into the field of view of the telescope, which is 70% of the sky. And in 50 seconds, we can double our coverage. So then the question becomes, OK, the spacecraft intrinsically and its attitude control system is fast enough that if you had this localization region, you could torque the spacecraft across the sky. But Daniel just asked the question about how long it takes to talk to the spacecraft. And I said, a day. And then I told you that for this guano system, we're doing 15 minutes. That's not good enough. Last month, we did 10 seconds. So what does that mean? It means that a signal came in, and 10 seconds later, the spacecraft was torquing across the sky. Big. This is not a small thing, right? It's a 1,000-kilogram spacecraft. Okay. This is an example of some other science that we're starting to do with this. There was a Chime FRB. It went off 60 seconds later. Chime sent us an alert saying, hey, there's a fast radio burst. 10 seconds after that, the spacecraft was already moving. 100 some seconds after that, it was settled and observing the position of the fast radio burst. And it's the earliest time X-ray and UV observations of a fast radio burst, or not only any observations of a non-repeating fast radio burst ever from space. And we're beating the ground-based telescopes in response time. So now if your command latency is 10 seconds, and the spacecraft is fast, and we're running these real-time streaming truncated template pre-merger early warning searches, and I have a very sensitive gamma ray burst search, and I have two supercomputers, maybe we can do something about it. The problem is that right now, although the gravitational wave detector low frequency sensitivity is pretty good, yes, please.
What's the first one, right? If you're triggering on the first few.
Yeah. For sure. So depends on your threshold. If you want a rate of 10 per year, then you have to lower your threshold lower than if you want a rate of 1 per year. And it just depends on how tolerant you are to interrupting the science of the observatory. NASA told us we can do this 12 times a year. So there you go. However, right now, the gravitational wave detector sensitivity, as I said, only gives us maybe 30 to 50 seconds, which can double our sky coverage but not get us the whole sky. And what you're looking at here is the number of pre-merger detections per year as a function of the time before coalescence. And here, as a function of the time before coalescence, the number of events and the localization on the sky. So for the current generation of gravitational wave detectors, 60 seconds is best case. We're not going to get 60 seconds. We might get 20 seconds. Maybe we'll be able to do something cool. But as the gravitational wave detectors get better, and in particular the low frequency sensitivity of the detectors gets better, things start to look a lot better. In 05, we're talking robustly tens to 100 seconds before merger, pre-detection, with order a few thousand square degrees localization, which is good enough for me. And as we build our next generation detectors, you can get hundreds of seconds. And with 150 seconds, I can get anywhere in the sky. Great. So we should build those. So imagine this future, right, which is not so far away, a couple years, where we have an early warning detection, send it to the spacecraft, slew it across, get an arc minute position. What do you do with that, right? We already said, once you have a position, what you want to do is train our most sensitive instruments, our Keck telescopes, our 30-meter telescopes, on the position of the target, Hubble, James Webb, on the position of the target. With this technique, we can bypass the wide field search stage, bypass the characterization stage, get a position that a telescope can slew onto in a minute post-merger. But what do you do if you have an arc-minute position and you know where the neutron star merger is happening a minute? If still Hubble and James Webb and Chandra and all other space telescopes except mine take a day to respond. And so we have to build a new space telescope that's built to respond to these types of things. So that's what we're doing. It's called QVIC, the Quick Ultraviolet Kilonova Surveyor. This is funded. We found out last week we have 30 million euros from ESA and the Czech government to build a UV telescope that is capable of slewing in, the requirement is 10 minutes. We think we can make it a lot faster and get on target, given a position, to sample the very early time in hot, energetic environment of the neutron star mergers. Not only does the response time matter, what also matters is having an instrument that can measure the spectral content as a function of time, because these things are very rapidly evolving. So you can't use a conventional, like a filter wheel. You need at least multiple channels simultaneously imaging. So this is what it looks like. It's 120 kilograms. The aperture is 35 centimeters. It simultaneously images in two channels, a near UV channel and a far UV channel, taking simultaneous data to measure the spectral energy distribution of the thing as a function of time. 3-year nominal mission, far UV and near UV, pretty sensitive. Okay, and we have funding to build it. But then you run into a technological challenge. So we came up with the design for this mission, and then they gave us $30 million to build it, and then we went to Teledyne, which builds space-grade cameras, they're basically the only game in town, and we said, how much for these cameras? And the two of them combined were $8 million. And we were like, shit. Well, that sucks, because that we can't afford that. And the challenge is that conventional CMOS and CCD devices are not sensitive in the UV. And there's many reasons for this I can answer questions about later, but this is one of the best CMOS devices on the market. Peak quantum efficiency of almost unity at 500 nanometers, but below 350, there's nothing. This has to do with the anti-reflection coating, the thickness of the deposition layer, the number of free holes on the surface, the reflectivity of silicon, many other things. So we're like, can we fix this? And so what we've been doing is, because we can't afford other UV cameras, we're going to build our own. And this is what our quantum efficiency in the UV looks like, about 50%, all the way down to 200 nanometers. And next week, we have our equipment in the lab now. We'll push this down to 150. And this is not just something we're developing in the lab. We're actually building it for a near-term flight on a CubeSat. This is launching in February on the first launch of the Ariane 6 rocket. It's a 2U CubeSat. I have my little ultraviolet camera in here. This is what it looks like. It's a 4K by 4K 16 megapixel UV CMOS detector. Sits here, read electronics here. I shoved a tiny little telescope in this thing because I couldn't help it. I didn't want to send up just a camera in a box. And we're going to image the sky in the UV really cheaply and show that it works. It's not just CAD models. It's being built in our lab in Toronto right now. This is our team. This is our sensor. This is our tiny little telescope, control electronics, sensor, optomechanical parts. It's going to fly on a near-term technology demonstration mission. And then we're going to prepare two of them, one near UV and one far UV, for the bigger 30 million euro QVIC mission.
The improved efficiency that comes from the manufacturer, right? Because you're not playing with the CMOS detector itself.
So we are doing the passivation.
Oh, you're doing the passivation.
Yes. I can get more into that in a second. So this is what it will look like in this magical future, where I know where a neutron star merger is happening immediately, and I can get all my telescopes on target. This is a simulated image in the far UV of a kilonova at 200 megaparsecs. is pretty damn far, especially if they're far UV. And we're going to measure the temperature and the spectral energy distribution of this fireball, of this maelstrom, as a function of time from the very, very earliest times. So what did this take? It took a lot. It took new data products and flight software for old space telescopes, new data analysis techniques and very hard calibration, two supercomputers that are always on, and burst computing on HPC. Like, I can't tell you how difficult it was to get supercomputers to start jobs in like a second. New command and control schemes and radio frequency engineering for space telescopes, figuring out how to coherently combine data from different messengers at the very, very low level of these data products, and cross calibration between instruments. A lot of plumbing, right? A lot of infrastructure and plumbing, unfortunately. Then building new technology, new space telescopes, and new cameras, and a lot of people, not just me, but a lot of people working together to build this future of watching the merger in real time. And this is the future that I want to see, is watching these collisions with our extremely large telescopes. Imagine if we could get EHT, or an Earth-sized VLBI instrument, on the position of the merger at very early times. Things like this is the dream. Thanks.
So for the gamma ray, your point was that there's not many backgrounds in the gamma ray, but
yep.
In the UV, you will point, and there will be presumably much more stuff that you will have to deal with, right?
Yes, so correct, good point, but I know where I'm pointing now, right? So the problem is that if I'm searching a really, really wide area of the sky, I have all this contamination of supernovae, tidal disruption events, AGN burbles going off, but if I know the position from my gamma ray search, for instance, there's no problem.
So within the field of view of the...
Within one arc minute, there's one galaxy within 200 megaparsecs. Order. No problem. And that also means that if I don't care about neutron star merger physics, all I care about is standard sirens, I don't even have to point a telescope. I know the position, I know the galaxy, I do my standard siren, I'm done. Yeah?
I have questions. There's already a two-week telescope. Have you thought about that?
Yes, we found out too late that this quantum physics detector, right?
It's a CMB detector.
CMB, okay, cubic, okay. I'm thinking of macro. Okay. Unfortunately, cuVic, the majority of the funding comes from Czechia, and they really like the name cuVic, so I don't think it's changing. We're building the cameras in Toronto.
Maybe you mentioned, what is the gamma resolution for your GRB?
100 microseconds.
That's better than Fermi?
Fermi is actually faster, but they only have 12 detectors to read out. I have 32,000. Fermi is 10 microseconds, and they use PMTs. Right? So Fermi has a scintillator and then a photomultiplier tube. I have a solid state cadmium zinc telluride device with mobility time scales that are longer.
Is this whole question of understanding the substructure of the gamma ray?
Yes. So what I'll tell you is that even though our time resolution is worse, our sensitivity is higher. And so for questions like this, you're actually mostly dominated by how much signal you have.
Yes.
So it's a very, and for this, I said we detected that magnetar giant flare. That thing was 200 microseconds long. Very, very, very fast rise time that we resolved out. And that's what told us that it wasn't a GRB. Yeah. Yeah.
So I got that point. So as far as I understand, in the first part, you said that due to the fact that the telescope was old, all the data analysis techniques, you had to do these use clever tweaks to improve your analysis.
Yes.
The new telescopes, are you, I assume that there are also improvements in the analysis.
Are you asking that now that I know that we can analyze gamma ray data this way, if I would design a new gamma ray telescope differently next time? Because the answer is yes. But is that what you're asking? Yes, okay, right. So historically, right, if you're limited to this cross correlation, you need something that's coplanar, right? If you're doing this, I don't care, right? All I care is that the response function of the instrument varies on spatial scales equivalent to my spatial resolution or spectral resolution that I want. So you could build a spherical one. It'd be really great. So instead of having 1/7 of the sky, I have the whole sky. I have, you know, a little ball of gamma ray detectors that sit in the middle and a nice sphere of occulting. I could have an active mask, right? So you can, right now, my mask is a 2.5 square meter composite substrate that I have 55,000 lead elements on top of. Why not move those around, right? When you have them fixed, you fix your field of view and your spatial resolution. But if this is an active mask, you can move them around as a function of time and make your field of view smaller, but your spatial resolution better, et cetera, and so forth. And all of these ideas, non-planar geometries, higher energies, using the Compton interaction and not just the shadowing to measure polarization, for instance, all of this is opened up with the new data analysis technique. Someone just has to build it. Yeah, Jeff.
So the map's 19 years old.
Yes.
What's the prognosis for having it put out to test?
Yeah, this is a great question. The problem with this telescope is it's so big that it's going to cost a lot of money to replace. About $500 million if you do it NASA style. So this instrument cost $150 million in the year 2000. So double that, approximately. That's $300 million. We also have not built another one since the year 2000. The last person who built this, unfortunately, a good friend of mine, he passed away recently. We don't know how anymore. It's not so hard. So you might ask, what drives the cost, right? I don't need complicated optics or anything, right? The cost is building this focal plane, right? The mask is not so hard. The cost is the focal plane. So if you can get me cheap cadmium zinc telluride detectors that I can make into an array, just like many detector technologies, the problem is making a large array of very complicated pixels, like whether they're superconducting pixels or my gamma ray sensitive CZT pixels, building a focal plane that's large enough and high enough pixel density to do something useful is very, very expensive. That drives the cost. India is trying to use CZT from the medical industry for medical x-rays. It's like 10 times worse, but 50 times less expensive. And that's what they're doing. But yeah, that's the cost driver. But I guess one thing I will say, if you use silicon instead of CZT, right, we can make arrays of this no problem. The problem with silicon is that no matter how thick you make it, you're not going to get past 50 kilo electron volts. Your effective variable just take dive. Your quantum efficiency takes a dive. So if you're interested in high redshift GRBs, right, GRBs at Z of 10 or 15 to probe the population 3 stars, where the peak of the SED of the GRB is shifted into the soft X-ray, this might be what you want to do, and you can actually do it pretty cheaply. Get a big CMOS detector or a very fast timing X-ray detector, mount it behind your mask, and do stuff like that. But if you want to go to the hard X-rays, it gets harder.
Questions from Zoom? If not, we can do nothing this week.